You are listening to continuing coverage of the trial of Chad Daybell from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Let's go back to the courtroom.
Court's now in session. Honorable Stephen W. Boyd, judge presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated. All right, Mr. Bailiff, if we could have the jurors brought in, please. Okay, thanks.
All right. Here's our president counted for your honor.
Thank you. Please be seated. All right. Good morning, everyone. We are back on the record on KCR 22211623, State of Idaho versus Chad Guy Daybell. We're continuing with evidence in the state's case in chief. The state has witnesses to call today. The court will note that the jurors are all present and accounted for, properly seated. The court has received the juror affirmation from all 18 jurors. Thank you again, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, for continuing to follow the court's instruction each day when we break. At this time, then, I understand the state has its next witness to call. Who's going to be examining the witness?
I will be, Your Honor. The state will call Dr. Eric Christensen.
All right. You can go ahead and call your witness. I'll note also the defendant is present with counsel, so Dr. Christensen can be sworn once he arrives in the courtroom.
And he is headed up.
Thank you. I'll just note one other quick thing on the record, too. I did have a sidebar with counsel this morning, just in terms of scheduling and planning. That was discussed off the record in terms of proposals for timing of witnesses and wrapping up state's case in chief as well, and when that may occur. So thank you for the information, counsel.
Solemnly swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help God. Yeah.
All right, thank you. You can be seated here.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, now that the witness has been sworn, before we commence with testimony, I just want to inquire, because this case has been live streamed on the court's official channel as well as other news media outlets and open to the public. So, Dr. Christensen, there's an exclusionary order preventing witnesses from observing other trial testimony. Have you at all watched or observed any of the trial testimony since the case began?
No.
Okay. Have you discussed with anyone else the testimony they've given at trial?
No.
Okay. Thank you for affirming that. With that, Ms. Blake, you can inquire. And I will note with this particular witness, if we are getting into any kind of medical terms and testimony, please bear in mind that our court reporter is taking a record of everything said. So please speak slow enough that she can keep up, and she can go very fast, but sometimes it's tough with medical terminology. So, Ms. Blake, if you'd like to inquire, you may.
Thank you, Your Honor. Would you please state your name and spell it for the record?
Yes, Eric Christensen, E-R-I-K, last name C-H-R-I-S-T-E-N-S-E-N.
Are you currently employed?
I'm currently self-employed.
What position, did you recently retire from a position?
Yes, I retired on April 1st as the chief medical examiner for the state of Utah.
How long had you held that position as a chief medical examiner?
I'd been in that position since 2016, and I've been in the office there since 2008.
Prior to working there in Utah, had you worked at other medical examiner's offices?
Yes, I trained in forensic pathology in 2000 to 2001, and then was employed in that office for a year. Then I worked in South Carolina at the Greenville County Medical Examiner's Office for 6 years before moving to Utah.
And what education do you have in order to be a forensic pathologist?
I have an undergraduate degree in philosophy from Brigham Young University. I have a medical degree from the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia. And then I completed internship training in pediatrics at Walter Reed Army Medical Center, and then did 4 years of anatomic and clinical pathology training at Madigan Army Medical Center. And then after leaving the Army, completed a one-year fellowship training program in forensic pathology at the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner in Richmond, Virginia.
Can you explain a little bit about what a pathologist is?
Sure. Pathology is a specialty of medicine, just like surgery or internal medicine or pediatrics, and it is primarily aimed at the diagnosis of diseases, disease conditions, abnormalities of the body by evaluation of fluids, cell samples, tissue samples, and in some cases, autopsy samples as well.
And can, when you reference autopsies, is that a special branch of forensic pathology?
Autopsies, training in autopsy performance is part of general training for all pathology residents in anatomic pathology. And then training in forensic autopsies is a separate part of the one-year fellowship in forensic pathology.
In Utah, because you've talked about, you've worked in some other jurisdictions or some other areas, correct?
Yes.
In Utah, with regard to a death certificate, who is it that would determine the cause and manner of death?
So in probably 80% or so of the deaths in the state, death certificates are signed by whoever the person's attending physician is. If they have a doctor who knows their health conditions and understands why they might have died, then that person will sign the death certificate. For the 20% or so cases that fall under the jurisdiction of the medical examiner in Utah, those deaths are certified by one of the forensic pathologists at the Office of the Medical Examiner. And those deaths are things that you would expect would fall to the jurisdiction of the medical examiner, deaths that are sudden, unexpected, violent, or otherwise non-natural.
And you referenced the medical examiner system. Are you familiar with another type of system used?
Yes, nationally, there is not a lot of uniformity to death investigation systems. At the time, just historically, most states had coroners that were part of the constitutional structure of each state, just like the constitution of the state might say each county shall have a sheriff that's elected on this cycle. Most of them also had a provision that said each county will have a coroner that will be elected on such and such a cycle with these required qualifications. Starting in the late 1800s, there was some change of that over time. So now there is really kind of a hybrid across the country where you have some states that still exclusively have county-based coroner death investigation systems. You have some states like Utah that are entirely medical examiner systems. And then you have others that are hybrid where maybe some of the larger metropolitan areas will have medical examiners, but the smaller rural counties will still have coroners.
And to be clear, you are not a coroner. Is that correct?
I am not.
And so your actual title would be medical examiner?
Yes.
And is the difference with that in large part your education and training?
It's mostly a difference in what the background is. To be a forensic pathologist, you essentially go through the things that I outlined in my education. You're required to have a medical degree. You're required to have training in forensic pathology. All 10 of the doctors in my office, where I recently retired from, are board-certified forensic pathologists. Whereas in most states, the requirements to be a coroner are that you be elected, that you be an adult. Some places require to be a registered voter, and you can't have any felony convictions or some variation of that.
And generally speaking, coroners do not perform autopsies, correct?
As a rule, they do not.
So that would be left to a medical examiner?
To a forensic pathologist.
Forensic pathologist. So when you worked in systems that had a coroner, would you still then be the person that would conduct an autopsy if one was ordered?
Yes.
And under the medical examiner system, so let me back up. In those jurisdictions, is it the coroner that would make the decision to perform an autopsy initially or to request one?
That varies a little bit from place to place as well. In most cases, it is a decision of the coroner to decide whether an autopsy needs to be done in a given case where coroners exist.
And under the medical examiner system, who makes that determination?
It's done by the medical examiner.
So a forensic pathologist, someone with that additional training and experience.
Yes.
Do you know approximately how many autopsies you have conducted at this point in your career?
I haven't done a final tally since I retired. I will likely keep doing some more, but somewhere around 7,200-7,300 at this point.
Did you end up conducting an autopsy on an individual named Tamara or Tammy Daybell?
Yes, I did.
Do you recall approximately when you became involved in the process of starting that autopsy?
We were first, our office in Salt Lake City was first contacted by someone in Fremont County in November, I believe, of 19.
Do you know if ultimately an order was received from the Utah courts for the exhumation of Tammy's body?
Yes. And under Utah law, for an exhumation to take place, it either requires consent of the family or a court order directing that it be done. And in this case, I attended a hearing in district court in Provo, Utah, where the request was made. I was not part of that request, but was in attendance, and the order was issued.
Were you present when Tammy's body was exhumed?
I was.
And were you present when her body was loaded for transportation to the office of the Utah Medical Examiner?
Yes.
Did you see her casket loaded into the transportation vehicle?
I did, yes.
When a body is exhumed, is it common for you or someone from your office to attend the exhumation?
Yes.
And are there specific reasons that your office or someone from you or someone from your office would attend the exhumation process?
There are a number of reasons that exhumations are done. And depending on what the reason is that it's done, there may be things that we would make a determination about at the time of the exhumation. For example, we had a case a few years ago where someone was being exhumed for the purpose of recovering DNA evidence that had not been collected and was not really usable at the time of that person's death in the 70s. And as the grave was opened and the vault was opened, it was clear that the whole thing was, you know, very much waterlogged and saturated. And it became clear at that point it would not have been a useful exercise to continue. And so we did not. But as a rule, there are other things. It gives us good information about the condition of the grave itself. Is it dry? Is it wet? Is it, hot? Whatever. Different things that we might look at in the context of it, and to make sure that if there would be, for example, any artifacts introduced. I've been involved in some where people had been buried in old wooden coffins that were very substantially degraded. And with the use of shovels, even with hand tools, sometimes you can have a potential artifact introduced. And so if you're there to observe what's happening, you can at least make a determination as to whether there would be whether the artifact occurred at the time of the exhumation or it was something that existed before.
Anything about the exhumation of Tammy that caused you concerns about being able to perform an autopsy?
No.
And as part of your role or your office's role in an autopsy, do you do anything in addition to just performing the autopsy?
Yes. So a forensic autopsy differs from a hospital-based autopsy, where the primary evaluation is aimed at determining what natural disease processes may be present and why the person died from a, mostly medical or physiological standpoint. In a forensic autopsy, we are very interested in evidence as well. And a lot of what we are interested in during an autopsy is what's present on the outside of the body. And so we will spend a lot of time, evaluating the external surfaces of the body before we delve much into the internal parts. But aside from the exam parts of it, the other big difference is that we spend a lot of time reviewing records, statements, police reports, other things that will provide us information of the context of that person's death. So just as when you go to your doctor, you don't just walk in and sit down and he examines you and then tells you what you need. There's a discussion that happens in that context where you are, you relay to your doctor what you've been feeling, what's made it better, what's made it worse, what you've tried that's helped or not helped, and those kinds of things, how long the symptoms have been going on. Obviously, we cannot speak to our patients, but we gather that same type of information about the events leading to that person's death by looking at their medical history, looking at statements from people who knew them, and things of that nature.
With regard to Tammy Daybell, did you in fact obtain some records to review?
Yes, we did.
Did you speak with individuals already involved in the investigation?
Yes.
And did you do some of that work prior to performing the actual autopsy?
Yes. And that's a fairly typical thing to happen in the setting of an exhumation. Because an exhumation is a scheduled event, we have the ability to spend a little time to gather what information is available and readily obtainable before we do the exam. So if there are things we should focus on, we can do that. So we had initially, I think, in this case, some information from the coroner's office. We had some information from the Fremont County Sheriff's Office and a few other items. We didn't have much of her medical history or anything at that point. And I think those were the primary things that we had prior to the exhumation.
In your experience, are exhumations very common?
No.
Have you been involved in autopsies on someone that's been exhumed before Tammy's?
Yes, many times. The first exhumation case I was involved in was 1998.
And when you're conducting an autopsy on someone that's exhumed, does it differ greatly from how you conduct an autopsy on someone that was not exhumed?
It really depends on their level of preservation. How well the person was embalmed, how long they had been interred, how the condition of the grave, as I'd mentioned, the waterlogged grave would substantially degrade the condition of the body. All of those things play into what kind of condition the body is in. In forensic pathology, we get fairly accustomed to examining embalmed bodies because frequently people are sent to the funeral home before somebody realized they needed to report the death to us. And so they get embalmed right away, and then they find out, oh, we needed to see them. So they come over and we perform an autopsy on that embalmed person. But for someone that's been interred, I've seen people that were both embalmed and not embalmed. I've seen people that had been, deceased for less than 2 months, seen people that have been in the ground for over 25 years. And the conditions really vary widely depending on that variety of factors that I talked about, the condition of the grave, the quality of the embalming, I guess those are probably the two main things that make a difference there.
And when you performed or when you were part of the autopsy, was someone else involved in performing the autopsy with you?
Yes. At the time, we had trained people to be forensic pathologists in our office. And at that time, our trainee was Dr. Lily Marsden. She had already, she was nearing the end of her training year. And she also had already received training and certification in anatomic and pediatric pathology and was working with us to be a trained forensic pathologist as well.
Is it fair to say that you and Dr. Marsden conducted the autopsy in conjunction with each other?
Yes. I mean, the way that generally works is the trainee is primarily doing the exam itself with essentially me standing there watching the whole time and guiding and directing, okay, you should probably do this. You should probably do this. Over the course of a year, our fellows become very adept at, knowing what to do. This obviously was the first exhumation she'd been involved with. So I was a lot more hands-on, even though it was the end of her training year.
As you were conducting the autopsy, did you and Dr. Marsden discuss some of your findings?
Yes, we discussed them both as we went and extensively discussed them subsequent to that. And the findings in the case are things that develop over time. We do the exam on the day we do the exam, but then we then get additional results as time goes by. We get additional records to review. We get toxicology results. We get other things that then require subsequent discussion and evaluation.
And can you walk us through how an autopsy is conducted?
Sure. In general, an autopsy begins with a detailed external examination. Initially, we photograph and document the condition of the body as it is when they arrive in the office. So that whether they're clothed, unclothed, whatever condition they're in, we take photos initially as soon as they arrive, and then again at the beginning of the examination. We then look over the external surfaces of the body to document any damage to clothing, injuries to clothing, any visible injuries on the outside of the body. And then at that point, we will generally remove the clothing and photograph the clothing separately. And then photograph the body unclothed before we clean it. Then we clean it and take photographs again. If we find injuries, we take detailed photographs of those injuries and all of that on the external surfaces of the body. If we find other things like fibers, hairs, other things, we will generally collect those as well. Once the external examination is complete, then we open the body and look at all of the organs from the brain and then the tongue all the way down to the rectum and all the organs in between to assess their condition, look for the presence or absence of natural disease, take samples for toxicology testing, and whatever other information we might need. There are some times that we do specialized dissections. Most of those are in the setting of trauma cases, where we will do detailed examinations of the neck or the spine or other things. But those examinations are sort of dictated by what we encounter as we go along. And we also do x-rays. At many cases do x-rays just to evaluate the presence or absence of skeletal trauma, because that's much easier to see with x-rays than it is during an exam.
I apologize. When you're looking at the injuries on the body, is there a way to determine a time frame of when those injuries might have occurred in relation to death?
Yes, is the short answer. There are a number of things that we look at that can provide indicators to us as to the age of the injuries, but many injuries, you can't really tell the age by looking, specifically related to a lot of blunt injuries. Particularly bruises. It's very difficult sometimes to tell just from the appearance of the bruise, whether it's new or old. I think all of us have had the experience of having a bruise that turns, you know, initially maybe blue or
Judge,
purple.
Judge, I'm going to object at this point. It's become a bit of a narrative, and I've been patient, but
sustained.
Dr. Christensen, when you talk about bruising, can you explain a little bit about what we see with bruises? I think you were talking about different colorations that we might see with those.
Yes. The colors basically don't necessarily tell you anything about the age of the bruise until you start seeing colors like yellow and green and brown that are the result of hemoglobin pigment degradation. But to see a bruise, whether it's red or blue or purple, you can't really tell when or any of those are of a specific age or not. They might be recent, they might be older.
In conducting the autopsy on Tammy Daybell, did you and Dr. Marsden in fact reach a conclusion as to the cause and manner of death?
Yes.
What did you determine the cause of death to be?
Judge, found objection, foundation.
Sustain.
Your Honor, may I respond?
Yes.
He performed the autopsy. So I think he's already testified that he performed the autopsy. So I'm asking what his results of that autopsy were.
And Judge, if I could respond.
Well, on second thought, I will overrule the objection. I'll allow him to make the response. And clearly it's grounds that may be gone into on cross, Mr. Pryor. But you can go ahead, Ms. Blake.
What did you determine death to be?
We ruled her cause of death to be asphyxia.
What did you determine her manner of death to be?
We determine her manner of death to be homicide.
And when you use the term homicide, can you talk about what that means in relation to your office?
Sure. It is different from, for example, how lawyers or police might use that term. For us, homicide is a vital records determination that we make. In this case, we didn't sign the death certificate, but that's the way we use the term. It's a determination of the circumstances surrounding the death, and it means to us that another person was involved in that person's death. It does not imply intent, although it does not exclude it either.
And when we talk about asphyxia, can you tell the jury what you mean by the term asphyxia?
That means that the person was unable to get enough oxygen.
Can there be a number of causes or different means by which asphyxia can occur?
Yes.
Can you talk about some of those?
Sure. You can have asphyxia can result from anything that occludes the airway, either externally or internally. So smothering, of any type, anything that blocks the mouth and nose could lead to asphyxia. Choking, anything that blocks the airway internally, whether it's food or something stuffed in someone's mouth or whatever, maybe all of those things can lead to asphyxia. Asphyxia can also result from drowning. Drowning is technically a form of asphyxia. You can also have asphyxial deaths that result from chemical asphyxiants. Carbon monoxide is one of those. Cyanide is another that impair your body's ability to release oxygen to tissues, and so they don't get enough oxygen.
And you talked a little bit about the process of an autopsy already. Any other obvious injuries that would have been the cause of her death?
The only that would be the cause of her death, no.
Can you walk us through how you ended up reaching your conclusion that this was the cause of death was asphyxiation?
Sure. So as I was just asked, we didn't find any traumatic injury that would explain her death. We also didn't find any natural disease that would explain her death. Her heart was completely normal. Her lungs were normal, except for some fluid buildup in them. Her liver, kidneys, all of her organs were normal. And so we did not identify an anatomic or pathologic explanation for her death. She did have the only real finding she had, apart from, you know, no lethal trauma and no significant natural disease, was some bruising on her arms and one bruise on her chest. And then when we get to that point, essentially no findings that will explain the death directly, then there are a limited number of things that can explain a death in that context. One is asphyxia. Obviously, that's what we ruled it to be. And that can be, you know, any number of things that, as I discussed, that can lead to asphyxia. But in this case, we believe primarily was related to some form of suffocation. But other things that can lead to death in that context that leave no findings for us to see would be things like seizures. There are inherited and even acquired forms of heart rhythm disturbances that can lead to a sudden death with nothing for us to see at autopsy. And then obviously drug intoxications don't leave anything for us to see. She did have, as I said, some fluid in her lungs. That's a very common finding in the setting of drug deaths. And one of the reasons that we spent a lot of time trying to evaluate for intoxicants that might possibly have led to her death.
And if we break that down a little bit, and I don't know if you use this term, but negative autopsy, can you explain what a negative autopsy is?
Yeah, essentially what I was just getting at, where we don't have findings, we don't have pathology, we don't have trauma that explains death. We have essentially normal, a person with normal anatomy who has died.
And so in this case, when we talk about it being a negative autopsy, is that because there was not a clear way to determine the cause of death right away?
Yes.
And you talked about one of the other potentials when you're dealing with a negative autopsy as being seizures. Is that correct?
Yes.
Can you explain a little bit about what a seizure is?
Sure. A seizure is a manifestation externally in some fashion of abnormal electrical discharges in the brain. That can be what you typically think of as a seizure, where someone goes stiff and collapses and then convulses. It can also, people can also have what are called partial seizures, where they may have, you know, movement of one part of their body, or they may have staring spells or other things of that nature as a result of seizure activity. But it's abnormal electrical changes in the brain that result in abnormal behavior, usually associated with loss of consciousness. And also not under the person's control. They just happen.
Have you conducted autopsies before where there were signs that a seizure had occurred or there had been seizure activity?
Yes.
And where would those signs usually show up?
So there's a number of ways. Sometimes those signs show up in the body. Sometimes they show up in the medical records. There's a variety of ways that we have to, you know, evaluate the role of seizures in a death. From a historical standpoint, if somebody has a history of epilepsy, then obviously that can contribute. But looking at the person's body, the main things that we might see would be things that you would expect: trauma to the person's tongue, for example, and that can be recent or old. And then evidence of incontinence of either bowel or bladder. Those would be the primary two main physical findings that we might see. But certainly people with seizures are known to die suddenly and unexpectedly in the absence of having had a recent seizure. Having seizures, having a diagnosis of epilepsy puts you at risk for sudden death. We don't have to have those things if someone has a well-established history to attribute their death to a seizure disorder or epilepsy. But in the absence of significant history and the absence of anatomic findings, we don't generally are not going to call a death as seizure related. And it's also not uncommon for people to have seizures as a terminal event. If, for example, you have a heart attack and your heart's not beating normally and your brain's not getting enough oxygen, you may seize. Or if you're diabetic and hypoglycemic, you may seize, but that's not because you have seizures. It's because of some other condition contributing to that.
During Tammy's autopsy, did you find any physical signs of seizure activity?
We did not.
And you reviewed Tammy's medical records, is that correct?
Yes.
Any signs of seizure activity in her medical records?
There's no mention.
In your experience, would it be uncommon for someone Tammy's age to have all of a sudden developed seizures?
It would be very unlikely.
And do you know how old she was?
49 at the time of her death.
Do you recall reviewing some information provided by Chad Daybell to the coroner or a deputy about Tammy having seizures?
I reviewed some records from the coroner, yes, that mentioned that he had said she had had some shaking spells or fits or something. I don't recall the exact verbiage, but something that suggested that, yes.
Did you find anything to support that Tammy had had seizures in your review of her medical records and or the autopsy?
No.
And I think you mentioned, I may say this wrong, but arrhythmia?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain a little bit about what arrhythmia would be or arrhythmia irregularities?
Sure. Your heart, in addition to being a pump, is also a very electrically dependent organ. Your heart's normal pumping function is dependent on electrical impulses traveling in a normal way through the heart. And those electrical impulses happen the way they do because there are what are called ion channels that open and close and allow electrolytes to move through the heart and propagate those impulses. There are both inherited disorders of those channels, as well as acquired things. Those channels can be impacted by certain medications and other things that put people at risk of sudden death by prolonging their what's called their QT interval. And so they having either of those, either something acquired because of medication or something that has been inherited, would put a person at risk of sudden death.
And when you looked at Tammy's heart, did you see anything that showed irregularities?
No. In those settings, most of the time, the heart is going to look normal. And so we would not expect to see anything abnormal with the heart grossly. Just to look at it, it would look normal. But we also would not expect to see, again, that type of condition manifest itself at her age, without some other, she could have it as an acquired condition at her age. If she had, for example, methadone is very commonly known to do that, but she didn't have any methadone in her system. There are a long list of other medications that can do that. Fluoxetine, which she was on, is also rarely been described as doing that. She had been on a very stable dose for a very long time and with no indication that that had been a problem for her.
So similar to this sudden onset of seizures, you wouldn't expect to see the arrhythmia come into play with someone at 49 years old?
Judge, I'm going to object to this point. That's a bit leading.
Sustained.
Would you expect to see the cardiarrhythmia come into play suddenly in someone 49 years old?
Judge, objection. Leading.
Overruled.
No.
And I believe one of the other things you talked about that could result in a negative autopsy would be some kind of an intoxicant.
Yes.
Are there sometimes signs during the autopsy that you're able to find showing that a death was caused by intoxicants?
There are things that suggest that. There are very few things that will allow that to be diagnosed at the time of autopsy. Most intoxication-related deaths at the time of the autopsy are initially certified as pending further investigation or pending toxicology results. Because there's just not anything that we see. One of the findings that is, though, very suggestive that we see not infrequently is what's called pulmonary edema, which is fluid buildup in the lungs. And that can, it's a nonspecific thing that can result from lots of causes. We see it in drowning cases. We see it in people with heart failure. But we certainly very commonly in our patient population see it in people that overdose, especially on opiates.
When we talk about intoxicants, does that also include poisons?
Yes.
You talked about a lot of times that we'll be pending some additional testing if an intoxicant is suspected. Did you do some additional testing in this case?
Yes, we did.
And can you talk a little bit about what, let me back up, where exactly do you obtain samples on someone that's been embalmed to have those that testing done?
Yeah, so as a rule, because someone is embalmed, part of that embalming process involves removing or at least diluting their blood with embalming fluid. So we generally don't have great blood samples to use. We will collect fluid from the vessels that is generally would be a mixture of blood and embalming fluid to test if we wish. But we do our primary testing usually on a tissue sample in an embalmed person, usually liver, because liver provides the best postmortem reference samples for the most number of substances.
And were those samples obtained in Tammy's case?
Yes.
What is then done with those samples?
So we then send them to the lab for analysis. We request testing for a wide variety of analytes. In this case, we tested for hundreds of different prescription, illicit, and over-the-counter medications. As well as a large number of what are called novel psychoactive substances, which are some are illicit, some are not, but they're newer drugs that are being used illicitly. We also did testing for heavy metals, did some testing for pesticides, did testing for some additional biologic toxins, plant-based toxins, and I think those are the primary things, but looked for all of those things in her samples.
Was there anything in the results that would explain her death?
No.
Was more than one agency involved in the testing?
Yes. So we had the majority of the testing was performed by National Medical Services Laboratory in Pennsylvania, which is a sort of the premier forensic toxicology lab in the country. We use them as a reference lab. They test about a third of our cases at the Utah Medical Examiner's Office. And then we also had some testing. They don't, for example, do testing for any of the plant-based toxins. They don't test for nerve agents and those kind of things. And we had those looked for specifically by the state's chemical and biological threat lab.
Would it be fair to say that this was pretty extensive toxicology testing?
Yes.
Was the reason for all the testing because it was a negative autopsy?
Yes, and driven certainly by that as well as the circumstances surrounding her death.
And in your opinion, did the fact that Tammy was already embalmed inhibit the ability to test for those substances?
For the most part, it did not inhibit the ability to test. Some of the results, we had to look at a different analyte because of, you know, potentially interfering substances from the embalming fluid. But for the most part, it did not interfere with that at all. And generally, it doesn't.
Was there anything at all from the toxicology testing that stood out to you?
The only significant positive result was the presence of her fluoxetine, which she had been prescribed for a number of years, and it was present at a non-toxic level. Beyond that, there were some, you know, a minimal elevation of selenium, which is a heavy metal, also at a non-toxic level, but really nothing else that was significant.
And you had talked about sending out for that toxicology testing in part because of the circumstances surrounding her death, correct?
Yes.
Do you recall some of the circumstances that stood out to you?
I mean, specifically, we would probably do more extensive testing in any case where an exhumation is ordered because of potential criminal activity. So that would be the primary circumstance, if you will, that would drive that for us. Not really any necessarily specifics in this case, because with an exhumation, you, again, like most autopsies, you really only have one chance at getting what you want and being able to test what you need to. Having that be the reason that this person is coming to you is primarily the reason we would drive that. And in conjunction with, then we get to the end of the autopsy and don't have any specific cause of death identified.
And Your Honor, I'm going to ask if I can have State's Exhibit 295. I think there were several subparts with it.
Very well.
And Your Honor, I'm going to ask for permission to publish 295E.
All right. Can I have a brief sidebar with counsel?
Yes.
All right. So there's some photographs that are going to be offered, and I'm not going to permit them to be published to the public in general. They'll be published to the jurors as well as the parties because they're graphic in nature. However, it appears we've got this issue again with the jurors' monitors, and if those are not currently working, that's where you're headed next to publish. Is that correct, Ms. Blake?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, we're going to do our best to sort out this monitor issue so the jurors can see these photographs upon their admission, but I think we may have to have tech run up here to sort that issue out again. So we are going to take a morning break at this point and get that resolved as quickly as we can. We'll come back on with additional evidence once those monitors are working. So appreciate your patience, ladies and gentlemen of the jury.
All right, please.
There's more to come in the trial of Chad Daybell. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our continuing coverage right here from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
What if I told you that right now, millions of people are living with a debilitating condition that's so misunderstood, many of them don't even know that they have it. That condition is obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. I'm Dr. Patrick McGrath, the Chief Clinical Officer of NOCD. And in the 25 years I've been treating OCD, I've met so many people who were suffering from the condition in silence, unaware of just what it was. OCD can create overwhelming anxiety and fear around what you value most, make you question your identity, beliefs, and morals, and drive you to perform mentally and physically draining compulsions or rituals. Over my career, I've seen just how devastating OCD can be when it's left untreated. But help is available. That's where NOCD comes in. NOCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for obsessive compulsive disorder. Our licensed therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention therapy, a specialized treatment proven to be incredibly effective for OCD. So visit NOCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call with our team. That's NOCD.com.